Hello, hello, hello. This is the My Empty Hands podcast, where we have a conversation about those that do Kenpo and whatever else happens to come up in our talks. I'm Reggie Darden, and today I have with me Peter Taz. He's the host of the Mind Sensei podcast, excellent martial arts Kenpo podcast, so definitely check it out if you have not heard it before. And so we're just going to, you know, have a chat about our backgrounds and the wonderful world of Kenpo. Just a quick, I guess, a quick summary of my history, my background. I currently train in American Kenpo. I've been doing that since May of 2022. I originally started in a version of Kenpo. It's essentially the Tracy's karate back in the mid-90s. And I've also been doing capoeira for about 17 years now. Dabbled in some other arts. Kenpo and capoeira, those would be my core systems. That's what I've been doing and enjoying and loving. And I guess I should say, I just got my green belt in American Kenpo, and I was a green belt. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And I was a green belt when I was doing the Chinese Kenpo, as we called it at the time. And then I have an advanced rank in, I guess it would be kind of equivalent to probably a brown or a black belt in that system. So I'm so glad to have you on and wanted to get your story. You know, how did you get involved in Kenpo, and where did that all start for you, and what keeps you?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Pleasure to meet. Thank you very much, Reggie. And also thanks for starting another podcast. So keeping the flame burning, which is great. I started Kenpo back in 92. I came from the world of bodybuilding. So I did bodybuilding for about 14 years and was a fairly hefty-sized gentleman. So I came straight in from bodybuilding and was looking for something different, and found a advertising in a magazine that we have here in Australia that used to be here called Blitz Magazine. And they had an advertisement for Kenpo. It was a little 3x3 advertisement, and it just said Kenpo on the ad, long and short forms studied. That was it, and a phone number. So I'm not sure what the marketing team was behind that, but I said, this Kenpo, this looks good. I'll try this, and gave that a call and rang the number on there and got the instructor that I ended up with. He was his first student that had a school, and he would drive down from the country to the city and teach his class. So he invited me down to the class to come and do a trial. So I rocked up and drove around everywhere. It was at you guys would call it a YMCA over there, mm-hmm. Like a basketball court area, and driving around, and it was all just no lights, pitch black. And I'm like, what's going on here? This is not good. And there was three guys standing around by a car, and I pulled up and put the window down and said, do you guys know where there's a Kenpo around here or something? They said, yeah, you're at the right place, but the instructor just shut the school down. Yeah, because he didn't have enough students and was driving a long way and decided to shut the school down. Anyway, I rang the instructor up and proceeded to tell him about his bad business skills and how we shouldn't be inviting people down to a school that he's shutting down and all the rest of it. And that had an effect on him, so he ended up giving me the phone number of his instructor, who ended up being my first instructor, was Tony Angus. I believe he started Kenpo in our state, because I can't seem to find anyone else that was precursor of him in our state, in our country, that taught Kenpo. So I gave him a call, and you know, he was about an hour's drive away, so I went down to that and pretty much left that night as a broken man, as you normally do when you go to your first Kenpo class. But I was a pretty big guy, but they knew where to hit me.
Yeah,
and I went, okay, this is different. We're driving home. I've got to learn this stuff. This was good. So, yeah, my journey began then. So it was back in 90, maybe 91, I think, 92. So I started my Kempo journey there. And that was, his background was Larderette Tracy.
Okay.
Yeah, so we came through, we had Parker names, but also with Tracy name techniques. There was a red belt in between yellow and orange, which was pretty cool.
Okay.
So I have a pretty cool story there. And we learnt nunchaku at red, which was really cool.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so we got introduced to nunchaku, and you had a handful of techniques you learnt with the nunchaku involved, which is good. So it was a pretty cool version of aggressive twins that you learnt. So for those who know aggressive twins, you're blocked with the nunchaku and your side kick the knee, front kick the body, and then you unleashed with the nunchaku after that, which is pretty cool. I enjoyed that belt. Yeah. But yeah, so after a few years of doing the, it was Larderette, probably 2 years or so, he associated with another gentleman in Sydney, and we moved to a different system and started incorporate, I think it was Kempo Karate Australia under John Van Wyk. So we started changing the system, and then he was very much into things had to work, you know. He was always evolving the system and moving it. So our techniques and ideals would change constantly.
Now, was this also sort of based on kind of the Tracy lineage, or?
No, it was based, it's a bit hard to say. There's been influences of Parker, because I spent a bit of time with John Van Wyk, and he did get involved with Parker, but then he moved on from Ed Parker to start his own organization.
Okay.
I believe the story goes it went from Parker to the WKK, Joe Palanzo's organization, to his own organization, but yeah, probably need to confirm that with the actual individual. You know, that's what I hear. So it's
okay.
Yeah. Not from the individual, but from others. So I'm not sure how true that is, but I believe that's sort of correct. So we got associated with them, and then we eventually moved to under Mr. Speakman with the AKKS. So I just went wherever my instructor went, as you normally do, and every organization and change that he made, the system changed, and he had to go back to the beginning and restart again. And as he was changing, he then developed a system where we kept the old techniques and the new techniques. And so say if you did your orange belt, there was a purple stripe, but you had to do a whole belt to get a purple stripe. It was the Tracy techniques. A lot of the other people just decided they would just get the belts and progress quickly. And I didn't really care too much for belts, but I did everything, you know, the belt, the stripe, any technique, any information you could get my hands on, that's what I was doing. So we ended up, I think in the end, by the time we got to Mr. Parker's system, probably four or five different systems of Kempo. So it was good because you learned there's more than one way to do something. And when you employed the principles and concepts from Mr. Parker's system to any of those other techniques or systems, it really took on a different animal, which was good. So it sort of helped make me who I am today, which is good, give me a better understanding. And yeah, there's a few different ways to do things, which is great. You know, that we don't have enough, you know, with what we have.
There's always room for more. So that's a good thing. Just to kind of backtrack real quick, because I had a thought when you mentioned it, it's kind of rare to do any kind of weapons training very early on. So you mentioned the nunchaku. Was that the only weapon that?
No, we did stick as well. That was at purple belt. So we learnt stick. They called it Kempo stick. I think they're all sort of blent together anyway. So you learnt your basic striking pattern. You had a handful of techniques. You learnt the basics of stick, which was great because then I had then incorporated into my system that I taught my students. They learnt stick. We didn't do nunchaku, only because nunchaku are sort of illegal over here. But we do that as a special seminar kind of thing, so we show them a few things on that. And then pretty much stick, there was knife, but that's just knife techniques that Kempo has. But they were the basic three weapons.
Okay. I find that interesting. So that the first school that I started at We didn't formally do any weapons until Greenbelt when you started working on staff set. And then the school that I'm at now, one of the black belts created a stick form or a stick set that you start working on as a purple belt. And, you know, when I got to that school and was watching someone test, and it was like, they were testing for their purple, and it was like, okay, it's time to do storm set. And I see him grabbing the sticks, and I'm like, hey, wait a second. There's no sticks yet. Like, this is a little early. Are we doing the right test?
This is good. This is good. That got you excited.
I mean, at my original school, you know, we did some of the Filipino martial arts stuff from time to time, but that wasn't like a formal official part of the curriculum. It was just, you know, a side, you know, we'd have a seminar or something and kind of work it on the side.
Yeah. But
I think there's something to having the weapons, at least a little bit of exposure to the weapons a little bit early on. One of the things that it's always kind of bothered me about a lot of arts is you don't get to do the cool stuff until you get high up. And it's like, at least give us a little taste of it, you know.
Well, yeah,
maybe
we
not have to teach the whole thing.
We did do staff as well, so we had staff set, but then I also introduced the short staff, the Joe, and had a set for that. And then we had a knife set as well. So I'd learnt knife set from Mr. Speakman. So we sort of modified that a little bit and teach a bit of that to our students. So we give them an introduction, I would say, is what it's called, because anything more, I think you're kidding yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good to provide an introduction at an early stage to. It does give them a better understanding to their kempo as well, because an extension of their arm. So anything they do wrong, it does amplify when you're putting a weapon in their hand. So it does.
Yeah, no,
I think it's a good
thing. Whacked myself a number of times with various things.
Yeah. But if you just do study FMA, Filipino martial art, they put a knife in your hand from day one. So it's working for them, right? So if you look at what's working for people. Yeah. But
I'm actually looking into getting into some Kali, and I've always been a big fan of the Filipino martial arts and the stick work and the knife work. Probably more so the sticks than the knives. I cut myself too easily, so I'm not sure about wielding a knife around, but I do really like the stick stuff.
That's why you work with trainers. To start with, right? So you don't slice and dice yourself.
Well, those can hurt too. So,
But, well, we did have an individual at my instructor school that has a scar just above his eye, and he loved to play with knives and different stuff. And I think he practiced with a shorter knife, and then we pulled one of the Parker knives out. You know, the one that Kilhibben created for his thesis, which is pretty much like a big Bowie knife, I call them over here, and had a different range on it. So he's come up. And just opened up the whole top of his eye with it because it's sharp. Mm. Yeah. So, yeah, you got to be careful.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So as far as your training now, is that mostly like the Speakman, or is it still?
No, I got my black with Mr. Speakman. So I was with my instructor till pretty much my first brown was the last rank I received off my instructor. That was Tony Angus, and he associated with Mr. Speakman, the AKKS. We had a school that was down towards where I live now, and there was a gentleman, Dwayne McGee, that started that school, and he was also part of the AKKS. And I think he had issues with visa or something and had to leave and move on, and the school was left with the students that were all part of the AKKS, and they rang and said they wanted an instructor. We love this stuff. We want an instructor. We got no instructor. And Kempo's pretty scarce in our country, and I think it is because you can join other styles, and they'll give you a black belt in 6 months and let you open up a school. So Kempo's typically over here, a Kempo senior will be 8 to 10 years training to get a black belt. So few and far in between. We're getting more and more now, But, you know, it was a bit of a scarcity of Kenpo black belts. So I think I was a brown belt at the time, and my instructor said, wants to go down here and teach these guys, you know. And it was me and another individual that put our hands up. I said, I want to go down that way because I'm going to move that way, so I'd like a place to train. And that was the crux of starting my journey down where I am now. So we were teaching for my instructor in a location down here, which is more Bayside of Melbourne. And he was more northern suburbs originally where we were. So we taught down this way. And then I said to him, I would like to teach children. And at that stage, there was a gentleman called Tom Cullen who was Mr. Speakman's representative here in Australia. Mm-hmm. And he was a very good businessman. He was, yeah, when it came to marketing and business, he was really good. And he sort of did bring a lot of stuff together in terms of the AKKS and getting people to join and memberships and all the rest of it. So he had a program called Kenpo for Kids that he franchised out to people. And so, you know, we were with the AKKS. That was where my instructor was. He was a representative. So I said, can I teach children? He said, knock yourself out. You know, you can start that as your pet project. And, you know, so that's where my school started. So I started personal self-defense back then. I gave it a name and started teaching children at the same location, which was a children's primary school, and was teaching children's classes as well as the adults for my instructor. And that slowly dragged on for a while. Wasn't a great location, but we did still have students and work our way through. I then ended up becoming a Victorian, they call it a director, but I don't know there's anything apart from a title that goes with it and a lot of work for Kenpo for Kids. And then I moved on and ended up, but my instructor finally said, you've done your penance, you know, you might as well take the school over now and run it, you know, as your own. So then I started teaching adults. So then I joined Mr. Speakman's AKKS as a school and was, you know, the representative for my area down Bayside. Here and where I am now. Trained a bit more with Mr. Speakman. Then he used to come out, trained directly with him for a period of time, tested for our black belts. So we had a test out here. There was four people that tested, and he said, it's provisional. You've got to retest again. And so two of us retested, the other two didn't. It was me and one of my longtime friends, Mr. Nolly Habibi. We retested, and yeah, then he was heading down the 5.0 road where he's going to ground stuff. And, you know, he wanted everyone to move with him to 5.0. There was a bit of a rift between Tom Cullen and him, whatever it was. So he wanted to push the 5.0 and everything else and take everyone under his brand. And it wasn't what I wanted to do, you know, for ground. I wasn't interested in learning ground fighting or heading in that direction. I was more interested in staying with Kenpo and stand up. And so I decided to, you know, he said, you can come with me or we can shake hands and be friends. I said, I'll take the shake hands and be friends option and moved on. And then I was a little bit like a Ronin for a while. I'd gone through all the, you know, politics and everything else and decided that I'd just do my own thing. The other gentleman started a organization called Kenpo Karate Australasia, and all the people that didn't go with Speakman were in that organization, and then they asked me to join it and be the director for my state. I sort of agreed and thought, well, someone has to help Kenpo grow, and, you know, I'll do that for my state over here. So I took on that role and just kept the school running, and eventually the Kenpo for Kids thing really took off. It was an excellent franchise model, and we had probably five schools in this, you know, in our state, which isn't, you know, for a scarcity of instructors, that's pretty good. And so we used to get together, and I'd run a national tournament, and then we'd have a world championship where everyone would get together, and they'd send all the kids up, and we'd have a, you know, big tournament with, say, 300 children competing, and we'd bring guests out. And they brought out who eventually became my instructor, Mr. Graham Lilliott. So I think it was 2007. they brought him out and he tested a few people, and we ran the kids' tournament, and that's where I met him. And he said to me, "I like the way you move, my boy." And I said, "Thanks, mate." And we sparked up a friendship from there. And Mr. Lelliot runs a fantastic international camp. It's every 2 years. It's in Wonder Valley in Sanger, California. So I heard about the camp and wanted to go and meet all the other Kempo people you've seen and read about in the books, and rang Mr. Lelliot and said, "I don't have an instructor. I'm looking to find an instructor. Is it possible for me to come to your camp? If I'm good enough, can I test for my second degree? And if I'm not, just tell me so. And if we get along and the relationship works fine, I'd like to start a student-instructor relationship." And he says, "That sounds fine, my boy." So Mr. Lelliot, even though he lives in America, he's from the Jersey Islands, so he has an English accent. So it's a little bit confusing when we get together because I have an Australian accent. He has an English accent. So, yeah, it tends to throw people off. So I ended up going to the camp and testing for my second degree. And, you know, haven't looked back from there. We've been together for the last 17 years, and I've just been training with Mr. Lelliot, and that's who my current instructor is now. Okay. So that's where I train and go to, and where I get my Kempo rank from.
Okay.
Mr. Lelliot. And we've had a great friendship and mentorship ever since. So it's been great. Yeah, so that's sort of my journey in a bit of a nutshell.
Very, very nice. So do you have any experience with other arts, or you've just strictly been Kempo the whole time?
At one stage, I studied Kyusho for a few years. So I've got up to my second degree in Kyusho Jitsu. And that was with Steve Stewart out of Canada. It was interesting. I've seen some of the guys do it and had a bit of an interest in it, wanted to learn a little bit more about pressure points. So I contacted him and started studying personally with him. I think it was probably a few years of doing that, and got to a second degree stage and decided that I wanted to head in a different direction and just moved on, but learned quite, it was good. It's a great art and is a great add-on, but you need a base art to apply it to. But it did make my Kempo another animal altogether, which is what they say. It's a great enhancement tool to your training. So I have studied some Kyusho Jitsu as well. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I really love about Kempo, is that it makes a great base for connecting with other arts. You want to apply techniques or, you know, philosophies or what have you. It just fits right in with Kempo. And this comes up in every episode I've recorded so far, but I was dating myself in that I really enjoyed the Panther production videos back in the 90s, and there was one with David German that I really enjoyed, and he was mixing jiu-jitsu with Kempo and connecting wrist locks and arm bars and that sort of thing, and it just fit right in with the system. And
yeah,
I always really loved that about Kempo.
I was talking to Ed Parker Jr., because we're pretty good friends, but I interviewed him as well. But we've had many, many, many conversations, and he said that his father wished that he called it practical, logical thinking, not Kempo, because, and it's true, anything we do can apply to anybody's art, not just ours. We say Kempo, but it just applies to anybody's art. And I think what he did was give us the tools to describe and analyze to the nth degree what anybody's doing. And the way I tend to explain it to people is, we can walk into any other style, have a look at what they're doing, and we could break it down into terminology so that we can figure out exactly where the power's coming from, what principles they're employing, what concepts they're using, the type of motion they're using. He's given us the tools to break that all down. But it doesn't go the other way around. And I think that's probably a blessing from us anyway, that we've got those tools that we can break everything right down to an nth degree.
Exactly. Nice. So I'm a fairly recent listener to your podcast, as we were talking before the start here. You're you're part of the inspiration for me starting the podcast. So I'm curious as to what made you decide that you wanted to do a podcast. You've had the who's who of Kenpo people on, so I'm quite jealous. But what started the desire to jump into the podcasting?
That is a very interesting story. Let me tell you, there's quite a few hooks that lead to that, or quite a few forks that lead to that main road. The start of it was 2014. I had the school. The school was doing very well, and pretty much the school was a financial aid for me to learn, travel, and meet people and learn more Kenpo and martial arts. So the school was doing good, and I decided I would fly all the way to Texas to attend. Mr. Lee Wedlake ran a Texas camp in 2014. It was a memorial camp for Mr. Tom Kelly. Steve Labowney was alive back then, and it had, Bob White was still around back then. Mm-hmm. My instructor, Mr. Elliott, was around at the camp. Steve White was there. Marty Zaninovich. There was quite a cast of very impressive people at the camp, and a lot that I wanted to meet. So, I decided I'd take my year's worth of funds from the school and buy a ticket and head to Texas and go and attend the seminar. So I did that. We went to the seminar, and I'm the kind of guy that is, they get a bit annoyed. I'm the guy with the camera, with the video recorder, with the dictaphone, asking questions. I'm the annoying guy that records everything.
I'm heading towards that.
Yeah, that's
working
good.
Towards
that's
good. That.
Well, the thing is, I was annoying. Now they're happy with me because I have recorded posterity and history. So at the camp, I knew Sigung anyway. I'd met him before. Did a few seminars. I recorded seminars, and one of the nights, Sigung was by the campfire. Really beautiful, nice Texas night. Sitting by the campfire, and Sigung starts to tell his life story with him and Tom Kelly. So Sibok, Tom Kelly, and his beginning. So I pulled my phone out and hit the voice memo and started recording it. And it was just a perfect moment in time. It was 25 minutes of him telling his story, how they started, where the journey took them. So I recorded that anyway. I had that, phone away, did the rest of the seminar, photos and great trip, and ended up flying back to Fresno with my instructor and spent time with him there training, flew back home. A few years later, unfortunately, Sigung Labowney passed away. But at that camp, I did get to meet a lot of his friends and students. And then when I found he passed away, I don't know how, but these things are weird how the universe gets you there. The recording pops up on my phone. Like somehow I come back to the recording on my phone and went, shit, this is perfect. Like this is before podcasts even, no one even thought about podcasts back then. I went, this is a podcast episode on its own. Right now, I just captured that moment in time. It was perfect in his own words, his own story. There's no denying it. And I went, why are we waiting for all of our, mentors to pass away before we do this? Why aren't we doing it now? Why aren't we capturing the history and lineage of all our seniors and mentors? So I said, right. I contacted a few of his students and said, what if I told you I could let you listen to your instructor one more time forever? And I went, that shouldn't have said it like that because it sounds like I'm a bit of a fruitcake, right? And I said, I'm not psychic. I just recorded him telling his story. Would you like a copy of the recording? And they were forever grateful because they could. And the best part about it is you can hear their voice one more time and relive that memory. So if you know the individual, it just brings back great memories. Mid-pandemic over here in Melbourne, we were the most locked down city in the world, more than Wuhan. So our state was locked down for 238 days. Can't travel more than 5 kilometers from your house. It was like Nazi Germany over here. So I had the school back then, and I had the building for a year, nobody in it. I'm running Zoom classes, so I'm like, okay, this is something, and I'm getting I'm not, you know, I'm getting unfit. I'm not moving around. You can't do a lot of stuff. So I'm pushing myself harder. And it was halfway in between a Zoom class. I was a bit dehydrated. I got a bit dizzy. I'm like, oh, what's going on here? So rang the doctor, saw the doctor, and he said, oh, you've got a bit of a heart murmur, my friend. We better have a look at that. So I had a scan. He said, you've got a defective valve. It's genetic, but we can fix it, but you're going to have to go through open heart surgery or you're going to die. And I'm like, okay. COVID had killed the school. It was hemorrhaging money. And then once I got that advice from the doctor, I thought I better pull the wheel. The universe is telling me to pull the wheels up, son. And so I handed in my notice for the rent of the building and put everything in the storage and then proceeded to try and get into hospital to have this operation done. During the middle of COVID, when nothing is more important than a few sniffles on the nose. So heart surgery, cancer, not important. So I eventually ended up getting into the hospital and having the surgery, and it's probably one of the hardest things I've done. So I joined the Zipper Club, and during my recovery, I decided that, you know, going from training 15 hours on the mat a week, cycling 70 miles on a Sunday, going to the gym 3 days a week on top of that, you know, your fitness level was, I want you to get off the couch, walk to the front door, come sit back down on the couch, and that's your exercise for the day, was a bit hard to come to terms with. So I decided I'd find another project, and I decided I'm going to start a podcast because I'm going to use the skills I have to perpetuate the art in some form, and that was how the podcast got started. So I thought I had Sigung's story. That was the crux of it. He was the inspiration for that. So even in his passing, he's still influential. It just proves that how important it is for us to record. So hence, even what you're doing, it's important for us to record the history of our previous, you know, lineage, in that they can, in the future, still inspire and, you know, create a vision for people moving forwards. So I decided to start the podcast and started with my instructor, which is what you normally do, right? So you started with your instructor, I started with mine. And pretty much I grabbed a recorder and put it down on the table in front of us and just started drilling in with questions. So I got his life story. And then from there, I just worked along the lines because I did travel. I have met pretty much nearly all the guests on the podcast, and we'll just ring them up and, yeah, just get them to tell their story. And I think a lot of them were, because I'd met a lot, they knew me, they were forever grateful that we'd done that. Then halfway through, I think it was, I'm like, yeah, different people would pop up in your feed, you know, like Facebook loves to listen to you all the time.
Yeah.
Suggesting holidays and advertising and other stuff. And I would get other individuals pop up that are not Kemper. And I decided that, why aren't we just doing this for, why do we say just Kempo? Why do we say just, we're dividing ourselves? We're always dividing ourselves. Why don't we just, I'm just going to do everyone in martial arts. I'm going to expand that project. So I will do predominantly Kempo, but I decided that I would interview anybody that's in the martial arts industry. So I did interview Tino Cerberano, who's the father of Australian Goju. Let's see, I've done Michelle Manu. She was fantastic. She's the only female Hawaiian Lua master in the world. She's great, great person, full of energy, great interview. So I'd highly recommend you chat to Michelle. She's great.
Yeah, I definitely want to reach out to her. I heard her episode. Well, I listened to all, so you know, I guess it would be a shameless plug for Everyday Martial Artist podcast.
Yes,
she's truly fantastic. Love that podcast.
That was my inspiration as well. So Everyday Martial Artist was my inspiration to get started as well. So I have spoken to Brian and mentioned that to him, and I need to get him on the podcast as well. But he's probably just as busy as us, if not busier.
When I decided to do this, I shot him a message and was just like, hey, you have any tips? And I was thinking, he's going to be too busy to respond back. But he responded back right away and gave me some great tips to get started. And that was really a big push for me to go ahead and do it.
I think the best advice that I would have would be that reach out to anybody, especially the seniors that You know, a lot of them think that there's a hitch or a plug, or I'm going to make this guy rich, or I'm going to, you know, he's going to, you know, use it untoward or make me look bad or something like that. But if anyone's listening right now, it's if all you got to do is listen to previous episodes of people, and you'll see that it's you'll get a chance to tell your story in your words for the future generations to come, and it's going to be recorded in history, and that's priceless, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, my whole plan for this was I want to hear the stories. Having a bunch of listeners is great, but at the end of the day, if I'm the only one that gets to hear the stories, I'm going to go to sleep happy. So that's just been my energy to do this. I figured that, you know, other people may want to hear these stories as well. So, you know, if no one else is going to put them out, then I'll do that. And, you know, so far it's been great. Everybody's been really, really supportive, and I've been getting great feedback, and I've been quite surprised by some of the who's who that have agreed to be on. So I'm really looking forward to that. And I just enjoying the stories and enjoying getting to learn all these great things. And it's even nicer when I get the really great stories. You know, earlier today I interviewed my first instructor, and you know, I had to really hunker down to keep the episode from being 20 hours long, because we could just chit chat about this forever. So I really love
supplemental
that.
Episodes.
So, yeah, no, I'm definitely going to have repeat guests based on just some of the conversations that I've had. I definitely want to have a repeat guest, and then also, you know, going to have other martial artists as well. My initial plan was to do separate podcasts, but now that I've started doing the work on these things,
it's a lot of work. Yeah,
it's a lot of work.
That's why I say I take my hat off to you, because I know how much work it is, and you ain't getting paid for it, so it's not from an incentive of they're going to be rich. It's definitely not rich.
No. So yeah, I mentioned this in a kind of little bonus episode that I put out today, but yes, I'm going to the main feed, so to speak, will be Kenpo folks, and then I'll sprinkle in bonus episodes with other martial artists. I'm sure there will be a lot of Kenpo people because I know a lot of, or excuse me, Capoeira people because I know a lot of Capoeira people, but I'm also, you know, going to be, there's a lot of schools out here, and a lot of people to talk to, and then just a lot of people that I follow online and stuff that I want to know their story too. So yeah, I'm going to sprinkle in the other arts as well, and really looking forward to who I get to talk to.
If you ask yourself the question, how do we get more people to Kenpo, is you talk to other styles. Because all martial arts are fascinated by martial arts, regardless of style. And it does bring a different listenership to the group. So, So I did Martin Wheeler. And Martin's a Kenpo black belt. But he's also now, what he's really into is Sistema. So he's pretty big in Sistema. He's in California. And they've got a very big following, Sistema. Huge following, bigger than Kenpo.
Mm-hmm.
So his episode has just hit number one on my podcast. It's the number one episode.
Okay.
Yeah, because they have a greater listenership, but that also brings other people that we wouldn't have, you know, to come and listen about the other stories. And I think it is like Mr. Parker said, he wish he didn't call it Kenpo, because it doesn't matter what it's called. If you substituted it with any other style, would it really matter? The practitioner of that style would just listen to it and think it was an amazing story either way, right? So, I think putting a label on it sometimes limits us.
Yeah,
but exactly. But it's been great. It's been amazing. I, like yourself, I say it's a little bit self-serving because I get to talk to a lot of friends, make a lot of new friends, get to hear the stories, you know, and then share them with everyone. So it's, yeah, it's been a great journey. I definitely, it's helped me get back to where I was. So from starting having open heart surgery to 3-year journey to getting back to normal. So back at the gym now, back at training now.
Excellent.
Yeah. So it's been good.
Okay. All right. So as we kind of head towards closing out here, I got a few little kind of fun questions that I like to throw out here. So first one being, do you have a favorite technique or 2 or 3 favorite techniques?
Okay. Well, it wouldn't be a Kempoist if I didn't say 5 swords.
Yep.
Thundering hammers.
Yep.
But some of my favorites are some of the oldies, intellectual departure, spreading branches, aggressive twins, and the other 150 or 148 left, I suppose, as well. I think that the best way to answer that is the way that I would talk to my students about it. I'd walk them up to the list of 154 techniques on the wall and say, what do you see in front of you? And they say, you know, white to black belt, or 154 techniques, or 10 sets and 10 forms. And I'd say it's as simple as principles, concepts, and theories. If you understand that, then you understand the system, and you can make any technique your favorite and work. So that would be my advice. But I think saying, you know, thundering hammers and 5 swords, non-Kempo people know those techniques. Because they love them so much, you know. Like you can ask a Taekwondo person 5 swords, and they know it now because it is a favorite, you know.
Exactly. So, yeah. And you just something that you mentioned just made me think about this. So a number of people that I've talked to love intellectual departure, and I'm kind of wondering why it's kind of pulled out of the curriculum. If that's a technique that everybody seems to love. I mean, at my school, we do that technique, but I'm kind of interested as to why it's not kind of officially in the curriculum anymore, if it's such
a great question.
Technique.
A great question. And with all the seniors that I've asked, the answer I have is that intellectual departure was too technical for a yellow belt and was replaced with sword and hammer because it's an easy step out, hand sword, hammer fist to the groin. And everyone did sort of struggle at a beginner's level with intellectual departure because, on the other hand, the reason I do teach it is because intellectual departure is the only inward-downward block that we have that gives you category completion in the system.
Mm-hmm.
So it was one of the few techniques that had that block in it. So I really like it. I have a lot of variations on it that I teach. We have the ideal, and then I show a few extra little sneaky moves that you learn from it, that you learn from other individuals. But yeah, it was taken out because it's a little bit too difficult for a junior belt level, and they replaced it with sword and hammer. In saying that, I think it just should have been shuffled up a bit further.
Yeah, I'm surprised that it didn't just move to a different belt.
When you're interviewing Mr. Wedlake, that's a good question to ask him, as he's very knowledgeable and technical, and he'll give you a pretty good answer on that.
Yeah, he's agreed to be on, so we'll be talking to him in a few weeks.
You can just tell him that Peter Taz said to ask you this question, and he'll probably start laughing because we have had the conversation before as well. Yeah,
excellent. So the next question would be: do you have a favorite form and/or set?
Favorite form? I'd have to say short form 3, which I recently did for a demonstration at the Hall of Fame Awards because it's probably our most dynamic form that doesn't require a packed lunch to complete, you know, because most of the Kempo forms are brilliant. They're beautiful, but if they're not from Kempo, you tend to lose people because they're so long. So short 3. And then I'd have to say I'm a bit nostalgic. I love the old book set, Panther set.
Yeah, yes.
Tiger and Crane.
Yes.
And we have a knife set, which is pretty cool. Yeah. So I would say those, but I can tell you a really cool story if you want.
Yes, of course.
We were at a up in a different state. I'll just keep it very general. We're up in a different state of Australia with a friend of mine. He invited us up. So we went up there to visit him. And he said, oh, we've been invited as guests of honor to this Kung Fu club. And so we went along. And so I went with my Kenpo brother that we got our black belts with together, and we're with our other friend as well. And we're sitting there, and what I love about him, he's very straight. He turns around to me, he's Lebanese, and he says, hey, Habibi, I don't think we're special guests here. I think we're just invited. Because we were just sitting on the sidelines. And I said, I think you're right, Habibi. I think you're right. We're just invited here anyway. It was a fantastic demonstration. They had their end of year awards night, and they had all these weapons, but all the junior ranks were doing, you know, the demonstration. So I asked the instructor, I said, do you mind if you show us an upper level form? You know, like I've seen all the great work your students have done and their forms, but can I see, you know, an upper level form from yourself? And he said, sure, I'll show you a secret form. It took my instructor 5 years before he would even show it to me. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be good. So we're sitting back and we're rubbing our hands and waiting for it. And he starts off and he starts doing Tiger and Crane, right? And I'm like, he's doing Tiger and Crane. So on the sidelines, I was mimicking the moves from the chair. But, you know, wasn't doing it to be disrespectful, was sort of showing, because my counterparts didn't know Tiger and Crane, yeah. But I had learnt it. And so I was sort of nudging them saying, you know, this is Tiger and Crane. And he turns out of the corner of his eye and I quickly stopped. Anyway, he finishes his form and he came over and said, how do you know the secret form? And I said, I hate to break it to you, but it's not a secret form. Your instructor didn't do good by you. He shouldn't have waited 5 years to show you. It's Tiger and Crane, and nearly every Kenpo black belt just about knows it. So it sort of shattered his world a little bit, but I think it makes for a good story, you know?
Yeah. No, I actually saw something online just the other day, and somebody was doing a form, and they had marked it. It's like, oh, this is traditional form 4. And he started doing it, and I'm looking at it, and I was like, that looks a lot like Bookset. Some of the moves were changed, but for the most part, he was doing. A lot of the other comments started popping up, and I was like, yeah, that's Bookset.
Well, so, the thing is that back in the day, when not all the forms were created, so if you get to talk to enough people, you get to figure this out. And this is the beauty of all these podcasts, is that you have enough guests, they all provide a picture to the complete puzzle that is Ed Parker. And I've traveled to different areas where they were doing old school Kenpo, and there wasn't long and short. Some of them weren't even developed back in the day. So they would have, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And at some stage, Bookset could have been form 4 for them. So, yeah, I think a little bit of understanding and question would probably go a long way, I think, in that respect. Because if you said, oh, this is Form 4 these days, everyone would go, you're doing Bookset. That's not Form 4. But if he was doing it back in the day, that would be another good question for Mr. Wedlake.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to speaking with him. I'm still finishing up his book, and just a lot of the things that he talks about in this book just really, really stuck with me, because his kind of background is kind of similar to mine, at least as far as kind of being sort of starting in a
Tracy system. Yeah. I think everybody started in Tracy, right?
Yeah. The Tracy schools were kind of all over back in the day.
If you listen to Mr. Lee's bonus episode I had, I think it was 20, the second part, he will talk about that. He will talk about that. Everyone, you know, they brought Kenpo commercially. They put it on the map, kind of thing. Mr. Parker started it, but everybody did originally sort of start as a, most people you talk to, depending on their vintage, if they're very old, they all started as Tracy system kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. And then last question here, if there's anyone living or dead, fictional or not, that you could train with, who would that be?
I'd have to say Ed Parker, for sure. I could say Mr. Lelliot, but I've already got that, so that's pretty cool. I'd have to say Bruce Lee. would be another one. Yeah, I think that'd be about it. I think Mr. Parker would probably be the cream of the crop for that. I don't think you can call yourself a Kent Forester if you don't mention Mr. Parker anyway.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Excellent. All right. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to mention or any other kind of topics you wanted to touch on before we close out for today?
I just probably wanted to say a big thank you for getting out and starting another podcast, because we just need to spread the word and record history and, you know, have it recorded for future generations. So I sort of say thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for starting your podcast to help spread the word. And yeah, good luck with it.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for being on. And thank you so much for your podcast, the Mind Sensei podcast, for those that may not already be listening, but I'm sure you already are. Once again, thank you again for being on, and we will talk again soon, and I will let you know when this is ready to come out.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Reggie.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.